Welcome to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Coming up in today's show, Taylor Charlstrom talks about how conservation has changed on cultivated cropland since the beginning of the 21st century, according to a Natural Resources Conservation Service study. Also, Sierra Polhemus joins us. She'll report on a newly revised flood prevention plan for the Central Valley. And I'll give you a look at national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In regional agricultural news, the Napa County Farm Bureau is pleased to announce its 2022 award recipients honoring individuals in the community who have made extraordinary contributions to Napa County agriculture and to the community as a whole. The Napa County Farm Bureau has named Al Wagner as the 2022 Agriculturalist of the Year. Wagner is the Vice President of Vineyards for Foley Family Farms, overseeing approximately 13 properties in Napa, Sonoma, and Santa Barbara counties. He is a former president of the Napa County Farm Bureau and is responsible for significant programming advances at the Farm Bureau, specifically relating to agricultural education in the county. Wagner will be honored for his years of service to the Napa County Farm Bureau and the lasting advancements he has made in the organization. Tom Davies, president and managing partner of V. Satui Winery in St. Helena, has been named 2022 Friend of Agriculture. Davies is being honored for his significant contributions to agriculture in Napa County, namely noteworthy contributions to the public policy framework of Napa County agriculture, as well as important contributions to agriculture overall. Napa County CEO Min Tran has been named as recipient of the Farm Bureau's Napa County Distinguished Leadership Award. Tran is being honored for his superior and quality leadership as Napa County CEO, namely his ability to successfully lead the county through periods of both diversity and success. The Napa County Farm Bureau's 2022 award recipients will be honored at the Farm Bureau's Love of the Land annual dinner on July 16th at Louis Martini Winery in St. Helena. Earth system scientists at the University of California, Irvine, and other institutions have drawn the clearest line yet connecting consumers of agricultural produce in wealthier countries in Asia, Europe, and North America with a growth in greenhouse gas emissions in less developed nations, mostly in the Southern Hemisphere. In a paper published recently in Science, the researchers report the trade in land use emissions, which come from a combination of agriculture and land use change, increased from 5.1 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent when factoring in greenhouse gas emissions such as nitrous oxide and methane per year in 2004 to 5.8 gigatons in 2017. In the paper, the scientists found that land use change, including clearing of carbon-absorbing forests to create space for farms and pastures, contributed roughly three-quarters of the amount of greenhouse gases driven by the global trade of agricultural goods between 2004 and 2017. Roughly a quarter of all human greenhouse gas emissions are from land use, according to co-author Stephen Davis, UCI professor of Earth System Science. He says their work shows that large shares of these emissions in lower-income countries are related to consumption in more developed countries. The top-rated sources of land use change emissions during the period studied were Brazil, where the practice of removing natural vegetation such as forests to make room for livestock pastures and farms has caused large transformation of land use within the country, and Indonesia, where ancient carbon-storing peats have been burned or otherwise eliminated to enable the cultivation of plants to produce palm oil for export to wealthy countries. About 22% of the world's crop and pasture land, or 1 billion hectares, is used to cultivate products destined for overseas consumers, according to the researchers. Commodities such as rice, wheat, corn, soybeans, palm oil, and other oil seeds occupy nearly one-third of the land used for traded goods and contribute roughly half of traded greenhouse gas emissions. In addition to adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, human land use practices have caused significant ecosystem disruption, degraded biodiversity, depleted water resources, and introduced other types of pollution to local environments. From an economic standpoint, the exporters producing the highest amounts of land use emissions are also heavily dependent on export agriculture as a contributor to gross domestic product. Davis says they hope this study will raise awareness of the role of international trade in driving land use emissions. In turn, importers can adopt Buy Clean policies to reduce the most emissions-intensive imports and discourage regions from gaining an environmentally destructive trade advantage. They recognize that several regions, including Europe, the U.S., and China, have seen an increase in efforts taken to improve supply chain transparency in recent years, which he says is a good sign indeed. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Deputy Administrator Janet McCabe joined Cajon Valley Union School District at an event to celebrate the adoption of zero-emission battery electric school buses that will reduce diesel emissions and protect children's health. The five buses were bought using $1 million in EPA Diesel Emission Reduction Act grant funding, combined with $1.1 million from the California Air Resources Board and $200,820 from ZVUSD. Over the lifetime of the buses, they will conserve nearly 71,000 gallons of diesel fuel. Deputy Administrator McCabe also spoke about a forthcoming new Clean School Board bus rebate program under the bipartisan infrastructure law, which provides an unprecedented $5 billion over 5 years to replace existing school buses with low-carbon or zero-emission school buses. By replacing the legacy heavy-duty diesel buses with zero-emission buses, the project has eliminated school bus tailpipe emissions in a community disproportionately affected by diesel exhaust and poor air quality. Exposure to diesel exhaust can lead to serious health conditions like asthma and respiratory illnesses, and it can worsen existing heart and lung disease, especially in children and the elderly. These conditions can result in increased numbers of emergency room visits, hospital admissions, absences from work and school, and premature deaths. Over the lifetime of the five new electric buses, they will reduce emissions of nitrogen oxide by 3.8 tons, fine particulate matter by 0.3 tons, hydrocarbons by 0.5 tons, carbon monoxide by 1.9 tons, and carbon dioxide by 493 tons. The DARA program is administered by EPA's West Coast Collaborative, a partnership comprised of EPA's Pacific, Southwest, and Pacific Northwest regions, which leverages public and private funds to reduce emissions from the most polluting diesel sources. California dairy farms will soon be able to feed their cows seaweed to fight climate change after the State Department of Food and Agriculture approved the use of a seaweed feed shown to reduce methane emissions from cow burps, the first in the U.S. to do so. Blue Ocean Barns, which produces the red seaweed at a farm on a big island of Hawaii, announced that the supplement had been approved for use on both conventional and dairy farms. Called Brahmanada, the red seaweed variety has shown to cut methane emissions in dairy cows by 52% over 50 days, but so far has only been used in trials. California is being really bold and putting their money where their mouth is in their desire to have a sustainable dairy industry, according to Joan Salwin, CEO of Blue Ocean Barns. California also produces more cow milk than any other state, and its dairy cows are the source of 45% of California's methane emissions, a potent greenhouse gas, according to UC Davis. The emissions are so plentiful that satellites were able to detect them being released from a large California feedlot near Bakersfield last month from space, according to Reuters News. The seaweed supplement will likely be available for commercial use this summer for conventional farms and in 2023 for organic farms. The variety that works to reduce emissions is still only available on a limited scale worldwide, and Blue Ocean Barns began ramping up production in 2020 to meet demand. It is adding more acres to its farm this year and next year to be able to feed 1 million cows by 2025, according to Salwin.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
Taylor Chalstrom with a report on how cultivated cropland has changed since the beginning of the 21st century.
A new report released by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service Conservation Effects Assessment Project demonstrated progress made through voluntary conservation over a 10-year period and showed how conservation on cultivated cropland has changed since the beginning of the 21st century. It found significant gains for soil health and soil carbon storage, while also identifying areas where additional and targeted nutrient management strategies are needed. Findings from the report will inform future conservation strategies, including USDA's effort to tackle the climate crisis. Dr. Lee Norfleet, who's part of the Conservation Effects Assessment Project modeling team, explained how farmer survey data was collected from 2003 to 2006 and again from 2013 to 2016 and compared against each other. His team evaluated conservation practice adoption through the cropland assessment using a combination of farmer surveys, land use, and soils information, along with resource models. The project findings are being used to guide USDA conservation policy and program development, along with assisting conservationists, farmers and ranchers, and other land stewards with making sound and science-based conservation decisions.
We saw some pretty strong themes in here. One is looking at how climate change is affecting what farmers are doing. It's not only the physical response to climate change, but the response to policy changes. So things like renewable fuels increase the demand for corn and soybeans. So when the demand goes there, that's where the, you know, your profit margin is going to go. And so farmers grew more corn and soybeans, significantly more, from about 75 million acres nationally for both those crops up to near 90 million acres of both those crops. And they're pretty intense production crops. So the farmers carried a fair bit of conservation with them in those new acres and changing their crops. Wheat was the big loser. Most of them switched from wheat to cotton. From wheat to corn and soybeans. And the Northern Plains area was where, and if you look at some of the climate change maps, you'll see that area got wetter and got warmer, which made it more conducive for corn and soybeans. And, you know, a good switch down for the, you know, the common wheat belt that was up there. So that's where a lot of the major big changes occurred. But the other big thing that you saw was farmers trying to be more efficient. They adopted variable rate technology where they're applying different rates of fertilizer across the field, tailoring the fertilizer amount to what that soil type and conditions may be best able to handle with the crop. We saw them use the several different formulations of enhanced efficiency fertilizers, which delays the release of the fertilizer to try to extend out when the plant's ready for it. Because a lot of times you put the fertilizer out, and there's just a seed in the ground, so it's not going to use a lot. So they're waiting for it later on. So both those things, big efficiency shifts, and really the more efficient they are, that means the less they're losing, and the less they're losing, the better it is for the environment. So efficiency is a win-win.
A trend noticed when both studies were compared was the move away from traditional tillage to conservation tillage.
In the first study, about half the acres in the country had at least one crop in which conventional till was used, and that had dropped down to a third of the acres by the second survey, and with a third of the acres in continuous no-till and another third in some type of other conservation tillage. So that was a huge shift there. Had major implications on carbon sequestration on a per acre change basis. About 39% more carbon was put into the soil between the two periods, which was about 32 million CO2 equivalents, something like that, was put into the soil and not lost. And along with that, also with that change, there's a savings in diesel fuel use or diesel fuel equivalents, depending on what your fuel is for your vehicles. But about a 10% reduction in fuel use or 110 million gallons. And that emission reduction was another 1.2 million CO2 equivalents, tons of CO2 equivalents. So those are some of the bigger shifts in that regard. Those practices and shifts changed where we had a 21% reduction in sediment loss from the fields. That's about 74 million tons, which is a lot. And wind erosion went down almost 94 million tons. So a lot less materials leaving the field kept in there. So a lot of conservation gains were had. More related to Central Valley concerns, I think, is irrigation. Nationally, we had about 5 or 6 million more acres of irrigated cropland, but we used nearly 7 million acre feet less water on that. So about a 19% per acre reduction in water use. The Central Valley itself had about 11% reduction in water use, or nearly 1.2 million acre feet reduction in water use. And it's not as, the change wasn't as high because that region already had a very high adoption of very efficient systems. So that area has by far the most efficient irrigators in the country.
Lee noted one trend in the studies that was of particular concern, especially Lee noted one trend in the studies concerning nitrogen that was of particular concern to the researchers. He said that more nitrogen was being used in the second study compared to the first study, and this could be because of new plant varieties being released.
Because of that, there were fewer acres that got the nutrients incorporated. They were broadcast without incorporation, with less the more susceptible to loss. So we had about a 6% increase in nitrogen losses on a per acre basis. And we were hoping to, you know, obviously we always want to make that go the other direction. But it's just one small change in farm behavior and the application of nutrients that can either be done by the co-op or the farmer themselves, is to get those incorporated. And we can improve our messaging on no-till. No-till is more than just absence of tillage. And when you change how you're tilling your land, you also need to change how you're applying its nutrients. You're changing the biology of the soils there as well. So you have a lot more changes taking the tillage away. And I think better education in that regard can make that minor fix, and we'll see the improvements that we wanted. Actually, what happens if you don't incorporate them and they're lost, it actually hurts your yield. So although they adopted higher yielding varieties, some of the best crops produced ever, they didn't maximize what they could have gotten without that. And again, it's just a small technical issue that may be compounded by the just the physical ability to get nutrients out in a short window. But with that being solved, I think we'll see a tremendous improvement in the environmental impact of food production.
Besides increased education on conservation practices, the next step that NRCS wants to see from farmers and ranchers is more precise application methods in nutrients and water.
Being able to tailor that to there and tailor the nutrient requirements like that will not only make them far more efficient, but reduce the losses. I think that's really the way agriculture should be moving, and seems to be moving that way with the concern towards being more efficient. It's really like no-till was in the 60s. It was just getting started, and then it took off, and now it's, you know, conservation tillage is the most common way to produce crops, and I think this variable rate technology will be as well. This precision guiding tractors, all these things can reduce overlap of not only nutrients but pesticides. So there's a lot of upside and really getting into the 22nd century, if you will, of farming. It's a high-tech business now. We've got lots of satellites to help the farmers with that. It's just getting that technology out and adopted.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
In national agricultural news, last week, the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee unanimously passed its Water Resources Development Act of 2022. WERDA provides improvements for the nation's ports, inland waterways, locks, dams, flood protection, ecosystem restoration, and other water resources infrastructure. It's good news for farmers who transport their crops through the infrastructure system and will allow them to remain competitive in the global market. A proposal within the bill would permanently adjust the inland waterway cost share to 75% general revenue and 25% Inland Waterways Trust Fund. It would also eliminate the sunset provisions to preserve these changes permanently. World food prices still took a small step in April after reaching a record high in March. Reuters News says global food security is still a big concern because of challenging conditions in world markets. The Food and Agriculture Organization's Food Price Index, which tracks the most globally traded food commodities, averaged 158.5 points in April compared to 159.7 in March. FAO's chief economist, Maximo Colon, says the small decrease in the index is a welcome relief. However, food prices are still close to their recent highs, he says. After dropping from the March high point, the April index is almost 20% higher than last year. The cereal price index fell 0.7% in April after jumping 17% higher in March. The vegetable oil index dropped 5.7% in April because of demand rationing, and the dairy index was up 0.9%. U.S. agricultural export values continue to top last year's number, but what about actual export volumes? USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
Ag trade numbers through the first 6 months of this fiscal year, October through March, show U.S. ag exports on the way to a probable record high for value, but
the volume side of things looks like a very different story.
Very different. That's USDA economist Bart Kenner. USDA listing 19 products in its report, 15 of those showing volume declines compared to a year earlier, including wheat, sorghum, rice, soybeans. Bart Kenner says there are almost as many reasons for the declines as there are products. Possible factors include
increasing transportation costs with oil price increases and shortages with the conflict with Ukraine. There's a lot of things affecting moving goods around the world right now.
Also, most commodities are costing a lot more than they did a year ago, bringing up this economic rule of thumb.
If it's more costly to purchase a product, you're typically going to not purchase as much.
That's right. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
AGCO has acquired JCA Industries Incorporated, a Winnipeg, Canada-based business working in the development of autonomous software for agricultural machines, implement controls, and electronics system components. JCA specializes in the design of electrical systems and software development to automate and control agricultural equipment. Their path planning, sensor fusion, and remote control software products are used today by original equipment manufacturers. JCA also has been serving some of the world's leading agriculture equipment manufacturers as a provider for electronic designs and software for autonomous machine development. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Farm News reporter Chad Smith has more on the American Farm Bureau Federation's Farm State of Mind resources.
Farming is one of the most challenging ways to make a living and can take a toll on farmers and everyone close to them. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Jessica Cabrera, American Farm Bureau Managing Director of Member Engagement, says mental health can be a difficult topic to discuss in farm country.
Farm life is definitely a demanding and stressful way of living. There are oftentimes farmers and ranchers will struggle in isolation. It is okay to not be okay. And May Mental Health Month is an opportunity for us to spotlight that message, as well as the resources that are available to folks who are seeking help or maybe who have family and friends they would like to be able to help.
Cabrera says both the Farm Bureau and many of their strategic partners have resources available to help those struggling to cope with the challenges of farming.
If you go to farmstateofmind.org, American Farm Bureau offers a number of resources, including a national resource directory where folks can find all sorts of information that are available in every state and Puerto Rico all across the country. These are hotlines, counseling services, as well as other support materials and informational resources.
She says it's incredibly important that farmers realize they don't have to fight through mental health challenges on their own.
We are a strong believer in our organization that we are stronger together. And even if someone is feeling alone, isolated, maybe even as if no one understands, if someone is struggling emotionally or has concerns about what their tomorrow might look like, I believe the most important thing is to recognize that it is okay not be okay.
Again, for resources on mental health, go to farmstateofmind.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
And information now on a newly revised flood prevention plan for the Central Valley. Sierra Polhemus has the report.
California is known to be a wonderful place to live with many amenities. One of those amenities is mounds of fresh foods that are available due to California being the breadbasket of the United States. Across the state, nuts, citrus, row crops, and many more commodities are being grown. A risk factor that poses a threat to the Central Valley, the hotspot for agriculture, is the risk of flooding. Chris Terrell, the Department Director of Integrated Watershed Management, a sector of the Department of Water Resources, is responsible for overseeing the flood management plan. Every 5 years, an updated Central Valley Flood Protection Plan is released to address the changing needs of the valley. Before getting into what the plan embodies, it is important to understand why the risk is so high.
Look at the Central Valley, I see several things. One is I see a Sierra snowpack. It has traditionally been our largest reservoir, if you will, of water that we can rely on throughout the year. We'll come back to this, I'm sure, but it turns out that climate change is really changing that dynamic, and it's less reliable as a water supply when we need it most. But if you think about the Central Valley, think of those high elevations, big, big snowpack water supply sitting up there at the highest elevations. So we'll come back to that one. That's one. Second thing is downslopes into the valley, you have a really unique geography, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. It's a very, very flat valley. So once you get down out of the mountains, you don't have a whole lot of elevation change from the bottom of the valley down in Fresno, Bakersfield type area, all the way to the Delta. It's very flat, which means that to the extent that you have floodwaters in that area, they're not leaving very quickly. It's kind of a big bathtub. The Sacramento Valley is a little bit different. It's a little bit steeper of a slope. You get floodwater evacuating a little bit more efficiently, but that adds to that risk. And on the other side, if you will, sort of sandwiching that interesting and challenging geography, you have the snowpack here, geography. On this side, you essentially have bay water in the California Bay Delta. And so another resource that is subject to the impacts of climate change. So you have sea level rise on one side, you have a more unpredictable and more rapidly melting snowpack up here, and you have a geography that is really challenged in moving that water back out to the ocean.
With this combination of risk factors, it is important to plan ahead for what might happen in the state. Along with these two other elements added to the desire for an original protection plan, and those were Hurricane Katrina and the conclusion of a levee-breaking lawsuit in the state of California. With all these in mind, a Central Valley Protection Plan was issued and has continued to be adapted every 5 years. The main premise behind the plan is to remember it is one thing to build it, but another thing to manage it. In the plan, there are many components, and many of which are required by the state.
It is a full accounting of every piece of flood-related infrastructure, levees, weirs, bypasses, et cetera, that are part of that system that we have jurisdiction or some sort of responsibility over. So it's a full accounting, not only of what's there, but what condition is each part of that Central Valley flood protection infrastructure in. Does it need investment now? Does it need investment in 5 years, 10 years, and beyond, so that we can better prioritize where we put our funds? It's also a policy document that says, okay, there's a lot, flood protection is really important, but there's a lot of other state priorities out there. Habitat restoration, economic development, agriculture being amongst those. So in the flood plan, we also talk about how these, I would say, historically conflicting, but now much more integrated interests can work together. So for example, how can we expand flood protection in our system of flood bypasses in the Central Valley, doing so in a way that also works for private landowners and farmers that are in that same footprint? Turns out that maintenance of the flood system is a really important piece of the puzzle.
The most recent update contains a few valuable changes. A key factor that was adjusted in the update was the increase in estimated costs to $25 to $30 billion. This budget increases as the understanding of climate change increases. Chris Terrell discusses another update.
One is we bring in a new focus on equity. So clearly, government's role in ensuring equitable governance structures investment strategies, making sure all folks, no matter who you are and where you live, have a voice, have a right to health, human safety, happy life, that also turns out should extend into how we manage the flood system. And as of yet, it hasn't, or as of up until today, that hasn't been a stated priority, if you will, as part of the flood plan. And so now for the first time in California, it is. And so there's a new section in the 2022 update of the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan that states very clearly that while we don't have all the answers yet, we're putting ourselves on the hook to investigate, are there historic discrepancies in where the state and other and state and federal government have invested flood dollars? And to the extent that there are, what are ways that we can rectify those historic inequities with the programs that we manage today, whether they be financial, policy, or regulatory, so that we can really make sure that we are leaving no community in the Central Valley, no matter how small, no matter how big, no matter who lives there, behind.
Climate change is a factor that is going to be a player in most of the revisions to come. This element has forced all of the sectors of water departments to work as one. With historic overdraft and new laws, a plan is needed. Working together and studying the effects of climate change will lead to a lower downstream risk.
Better understand what's happening with that snowpack. To better understand what's happening with these atmospheric rivers that come in and do cause the vast majority of flood risk-related damages. As we better understand sea level rise on the other side of the valley, we get a better sense of what it's going to take as far as investments into the system of levees to really address public safety and long-term resilience. And what's really interesting to me is the convergence of these two pieces in many ways, the equity piece and then the climate-driven increase in costs, is this plan takes another meaningful step at really establishing the Central Valley flood system as part of the bigger Central Valley water management system. Right? Historically, we've kept these conversations very siloed. Flood management over here, wastewater management over here, water supply over here, groundwater management over here. But it turns out that it's one system, and the flood system is actually integral to all of those pieces.
The updated version of the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan is out for public review and will be finalized in the months to come. This is Sierra Pulhemus with My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. That is there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.